This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear about current and former Bloomington High School girls possibly exploited online. There's a website claiming to trade nude photos of those students.
The unfortunate reality is, in today's world, we have a lot that we have to work with as a society when it comes to the internet.
District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley talks with Charlie Schlenker, and you'll hear from an ISU expert on these kinds of deplorable instances. Throw away that microwave popcorn and find out how to grow your own. Laura Kennedy and Patrick Murphy have the tips on an edition of Grow. And the McLean County Behavioral Health Community Forum is underway today. You'll hear from one of the presenters about faith-based mental health care. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's May 18th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Photos of Bloomington High School students may be on a website where nude photos are solicited and traded. Eureka High School in Woodford County and East Peoria High School are also on the list of 67 Illinois high schools that have folders on the site, exposed by an NBC Chicago TV report. Some of the photos are certainly of underage girls. GLT's Charlie Schlenker spoke with District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley for his reaction.
Unfortunate reality is, in today's world, we have a lot that we have to work with as a society when it comes to the internet, and with all the good that comes with it, there are some things that are negative and bad, and the unfortunate reality is that's the way life is right now. Obviously, it's really concerning to us anytime our name gets attached to that, but more importantly, anyone who is a victim of this. Those are the folks that really need to reach out to the local authorities for follow-up, and hopefully they can get some things done. I'm not aware of any particular individual. We have not done any, nor do we have any plans to do our own investigation. This is something that needs to be handled by the local and maybe even beyond the local authorities, but certainly it's something that concerns us to have our name attached to that.
What have you done regarding this?
We've alerted our local authorities, and that's the extent of what we've done. And obviously, if you know we have any news of any impact on any current student, which I've not heard that, we would certainly be in contact with families and the local authorities as well.
Is this deplorable?
Absolutely. This is something that you go back to the challenges, whether it's with some things associated with social media, cyberbullying. This is, you could even argue, is more deplorable than that. But the unfortunate reality is you have some few individuals out there who will engage in these types of negative behaviors out on the internet, and it's unfortunate. It's absolutely deplorable.
How does District 87 already try to encourage responsible online behavior and discourage crummy actions like this?
Well, this specific action is not exactly covered, but certainly we have embedded in our curriculum the appropriate ways to, whether it's through social media or email or anything related to something you put out online. We do have things in our curriculum that address that, going back to the elementary school all the way through high school. We also have an acceptable use policy. We have filtering. We have monitoring that helps us. We work with a company called Gaggle that monitors student email, and that's been helpful to really reduce things related to cyberbullying and even depression. And in a couple of cases, things that could have related to an individual harming him or herself. So we've got a wealth of resources that help us to work with kids and families. But the reality is, you know, the internet is such a 24/7 part of everybody's lives that it's not something that, you know, we're structured to do 24/7. And you, what we do is just like what you would do as a parent, is you arm your kids with the best information and try to mold them to make good decisions. And in the end, you know, as they grow and mature, you hope you've done that in a way that they will make good choices relative to those things. And, you know, all of us have things that we do, we look back on when we're young, that we wish we would have made better choices. The unfortunate reality with the internet is today, those things can be out there, and they can be out there forever. And the reality with this particular website that has come up, that's not even, to my knowledge, that's not even a website that's housed here in this country. So the recourse for individuals that are impacted are, you know, difficult to, you know, to get rid of that stuff. And, you know, I'm not one who has investigated this thoroughly. There are oftentimes when I find information that is reported to be about our schools or a school or our district or individuals that might be associated with this district that sometimes turn out not to be even factual. So I wouldn't, it wouldn't surprise me if down the road through investigation that, you know, that could be the case as well. I'm not saying that that is the case. I just don't know.
What can we as a society do to make this culturally unacceptable? I mean, we'll always have aberrations, but between the Marine Corps women scandal and the hacking of Hollywood celebrities, we seem to be seeing more incidents than just aberrational ones.
Well, Charlie, if you have the answer to that, I'm interested in knowing it. You know, this is, if you go back through generation after generation, you always have, throughout life, people will make mistakes. People will do things that they wish they haven't done, and some of which are bad things. And the unfortunate reality is, I think that we can put in place lots of things to minimize risk, and with the hopes of eliminating it. But as time always tells, there are always those select few who, no matter what you do to minimize that, there will be those who have intent that is not good. And the unfortunate reality with the internet is, you know, if you have the means to do those kinds of things, it can put it out there for the masses, where in the past that just wasn't the case. So I don't have the magic answer as to what we do. I think as educators, again, we try to arm kids with the ability to make good choices, and that's what we want from our parents as well. But, you know, this is not isolated to schools, for schools to figure it out. This is for leaders in government, you know, for adults to be good role models. And, you know, you look across our country today, there's a strong divisiveness, and there seems to be more acceptance of, you know, things that may or may not be factual. I mean, that's very clear in the news today. And I don't have the silver bullet to eliminate it. I think the more we do to, again, arm our kids with the ability to make good choices, that's the best we can do.
If Bloomington police uncover students who've been trading such photos of other students, what happens to them within the district?
Well, Charlie, that's a very broad question to which I'm not going to have a great answer for you at the moment, because those would be looked at on a case-by-case basis. You know, we do, again, we have acceptable use policies. Some of it could depend on where they're doing it at and the impact that it has on the school, the impact it would have on others. But I'm not going to focus on that at this moment, because I have absolutely zero knowledge of any kid that's involved in this. If that's brought to our attention, then we'll address it. But at this point, that is not anything that we've been made aware of.
What else should be added at this point?
Again, I think it's incumbent upon parents to be, today, probably more than ever, you need to be vigilant about communicating with your children and know what's going on in their lives. I think too often we, and I've been guilty of this as well as a parent, we turn our kids over to the tablet, to the computer, to entertain them in ways that we never did in the past. And it's out of convenience for us, but the importance of communicating with your kids cannot be underestimated. And I think the more that we do that and stay involved in their lives, the less likelihood of negative things happening will occur. It doesn't eliminate that. It's not foolproof, but certainly it's a step to minimizing those risks.
Bloomington School Superintendent Barry Riley speaking with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington police say District 87 notified them on Wednesday. A spokesman said details are not known to BPD because requests from the district to NBC5 to gain specifics have gone unanswered. The spokesman said if and when BPD is given more information, the Criminal Investigations Division can proceed. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois State University Criminal Justice Sciences Professor Shelley Clevenger is an expert in cybercrime, especially incidents of sexual abuse or assault disseminated on the internet. She tells GLT's Judy Valente that sites like the one which traffics in nude photographs and that publishes images like those of Bloomington High School students are proliferating. But the law has yet to catch up to the technology that makes these cybercrimes possible.
On this website, there's a lot of different categories. So when one goes to this website, you can search for nude or semi-nude images based on categories. So, for example, you can look for college bitches, accidental nudes, which most of the photos would be pictures that were taken without someone's knowledge or even aware that they were having their photo taken at all. Some amateur teen photos. And they also have a search where you can search for, and this is their title, not mine, sluts by state. And you can search by state and also specifically by county. And currently there was 67 high schools listed on there for Illinois. So I could go on and search for a high school in Illinois and pictures would potentially come up of girls who attended those high schools.
It is illegal, isn't it, to take someone's picture, particularly someone in a state of undress, and put it up on the internet?
Yes, it is. And in Illinois, we are one of, I believe, 36 states that has a revenge porn statute. And unless that person is giving permission for you to disseminate that photo, you are not allowed to just place that in public, the public arena for people to view.
What motivates people to do something like that? Get hold of a nude picture or take a picture that they have and put it up on the internet?
I would say there are different motivations. One might be a ex-spouse or intimate partner who is angry with that person. And so this is a way of getting revenge or getting back at them by putting this picture up there. For this case, for this website, a lot of those pictures are actually just pictures of people they don't know or didn't have an intimate partner relationship with. And so I would say for that, it's seeing women as objects, not really thinking about them as people or that they have value beyond their attractiveness or their bodies.
This case, as you mentioned, relates to high school students, mostly high school girls. What do we need to be teaching young people, especially young men, about appropriate and moral use of social media and the internet?
Which is a hard question. But I think that part of this is societal in the fact that we often value women for how they look. And so for a lot of these young men, which it's young men who are, you know, principally the users, they would see these women as sexual objects. They don't think that they're doing any harm. They just like looking at their bodies. They like looking at these pictures. They don't have any empathy or sympathy for what that woman would experience by seeing her picture online, her naked picture, her body that she does not want the world to see, they don't think about what it would be like to be that person. So I think empathy, sympathy, and then also value for women beyond their physical appearance.
Well, I'm just curious. I mean, don't these people know about Playboy and Hustler? I mean, you can get the same thing in a much more polished version. What's the allure of these kinds of candid pictures?
The allure, I think, is that they're real people who they may know. And so, especially if you wanted to find somebody who went to your high school or someone in your community and you wanted to see what they look like naked, this website could potentially give you that opportunity. Whereas, you know, the women in Playboy, they usually don't know. I mean, they potentially could, but they don't know them. And then they also, you know, could potentially access these women if they wanted to.
What would you tell the young women themselves? Because in some cases, they shared these pictures with mm-hmm. people they thought were friends or boyfriends. What should we be telling them?
That is a hard one to answer also, because as young women, especially if we're talking about the high school aged girls, you want to express yourself to the person you're in a relationship with. And so us as adults saying to them, don't take naked pictures, don't take naked videos, don't send these to your boyfriends. We can say that. And, you know, maybe that is even the best strategy. But realistically, I don't think that that's going to happen. I think that most people who share these pictures or videos think that that person would never do that. So, you know, the best advice you can give anyone is to be careful and not, I always tell my students not to victim blame, because no one thinks that that's going to happen to them, and they don't go into sending that photo thinking that it would end up on the internet.
As you referenced before, 67 schools were on this list mm-hmm. as having some of their female students online. A half of them, when they were asked by the NBC affiliate in Chicago to respond, said they had no idea. How could the schools not be aware that this is going on?
I would say unless the students are actively talking about it within hearing range of teachers or, you know, administrators, people who work at the school, they're probably pretty oblivious to a lot of things that go on within the school. And, you know, thinking about this in terms of even the parents might have no idea that this website exists or that their child was even sending these pictures to their boyfriend or girlfriend.
What do you think schools can do?
We focused recently on a lot of cyberbullying, and we've been talking about bullying in schools, but we haven't necessarily addressed things from a sexual nature. And this, I think, is something that needs to be addressed. And anything that relates to sex, schools usually do not want to touch
right.
Or address. But I think that if this is happening to students in our schools, it's something that we need to talk about.
How about parents?
I would say parents need to talk about it also with their children. But once again, children, you know, parents don't want to talk to their children about sex, and children don't want to talk to their parents about sex. But I think that people need to understand that this is not just an image on a screen, that this is a real person who is probably suffering as a result of having their picture on the internet.
You were in here just a few weeks ago. We were talking about a rape that was live streamed on the internet, on Facebook. These incidents seem to be increasing.
It is increasing. And particularly in the younger sort of generation or segment of the population, which kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, people do not seem to connect with what is on the screen to a real person. People often don't think it's as serious because it's on the internet. And I'm not sure what we can do to change that. The Facebook Live rape and the Facebook Live murder were the extreme versions of that. But here on this website, we see all of these images of young girls and people, you know, collecting them and sort of trading them almost like they're trading cards or baseball cards of people, you know, wanting to get these naked images of people that they know. I'm not sure where that exactly comes from, but I don't think it's going to go away.
talk a little bit more about the recourse women had. You said that there is a revenge law in Illinois. Is there anything else that they can do to, A, prevent this from happening, and B, once it happens, get that stuff off the internet?
Prevention, obviously, would be don't have any naked pictures of yourself. So this isn't just sending it to a partner or a friend. This can also be having naked pictures on your computer or phone, because sometimes people are hacking into people's personal clouds or personal devices or taking it off of that device. So if you really want to protect yourself, don't have that available. Like I said, that's not often the most realistic option. If it does happen to you and you did see it, the best thing would be to do is to take a screenshot. So you would have that image captured and write down all of the information, you know, so the time that you saw it, the date, if it said who posted it. So sometimes these are anonymous, but you could write down the numbers or the username and be able to have that information to show to law enforcement.
Can law enforcement do much about this, though, after the fact?
It depends on who disseminated the photo. It also depends on the server of who the internet company is that is housing these photos. So for the Anon IB, it is an overseas server. And so that presents some problems with jurisdiction and who is responsible for enforcing these laws of things that are happening here in the United States.
So there's a lot of area in the law that needs to be updated to address some of these issues.
Yes. And the internet is, you know, a tricky thing that a lot of people are still trying to work to understand.
And what about the internet companies themselves? You know, Facebook and Google and Instagram and all of that. Who oversees something like Anon IB, the site that we're talking about?
So for this site in particular, I was looking today. There is a petition to get this site shut down. So they were collecting signatures to go to the FBI. They want this site shut down because of the implications for child pornography, but then also for implications of violence against women and treatment of women, because it's women that are on this site. And so thinking about this, you know, can we get this site shut down? I don't know. A lot of these types of sites might, even if they do get shut down, pop back up under a different name. My own personal opinion, I don't think that these sites serve any purpose. I would argue that this is different than a pornography site, as these are real people who did not necessarily give permission for their images to be on the internet.
Would it be different if it was on Facebook or Google or Instagram?
I think so. I mean, Facebook and Instagram have both taken measures to try to ensure that these things don't happen and taking down images. You know, there's been scrutiny of, well, how quick is, you know, fast or we, you know, rapidly take down these images. But this site, it lives basically to post naked pictures or semi-nude pictures of women, whereas Facebook or Instagram serve other purposes. Unfortunately, people do use it for this purpose, but oftentimes those images are eventually removed.
Dr. Shelley Clevenger is with the Criminal Justice Sciences Department at ISU. She is the author of The Virtual Enemy, The Intersection Between Intimate Partner Violence, Technology, and Cybercrime. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
Clevenger says many internet companies like Facebook and Google have responded to criticism by cracking down on some of the inappropriate content put on sites. The problem is those kinds of companies can't keep up with the quantity of such content. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
The McLean County Behavioral Health Community Forum is underway today. Coming up, you'll hear about faith-based mental health care. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. One of America's favorite snack foods is very nutritious and easy to grow in your own backyard. All you need is soil, sun, water, and patience. Patrick Murphy and Laura Kennedy have more on this edition of GLT's Grow.
You can take movie night to a new level by serving up your own homegrown popcorn. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. It's Patrick Murphy. Hello there, Murph.
Hi, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, Murph has advice on how to grow popcorn. How exciting.
Corn is cool. Corn is king, and it's also among the most popular and most used and domesticated vegetables. You got your sweet corn, obviously, you know, you got your green giant niblets, but you got all the other stuff, the corn syrup and the corn fiber makes all the junk food and sweetens lots of junk food.
Yeah, we all love
but,
that.
But hey, you got your corn bread, your corn chowder, your corn cakes, it's all good.
It's all corny.
Wonderful. Yeah. But popcorn is a little bit different than regular corn because it's a specific corn cultivar.
Yeah.
And there are few to choose from. I notice there's some repetition. There's not a lot of diversity in popcorn, but...
there's not a lot of diversity, huh? Okay.
It's kind of cut and dry, but there's some interesting stuff about it. This popcorn plant looks just like corn. It gets 1 to 2 ears per plant in a garden, you know, and it requires the same amount of space.
Mm-hmm. How much space is that?
8 to 10 inches apart, and that's a lot, right?
So. Uh-huh.
There at the compound, at the Kennedy compound, it's all about small space gardening. It might not be the perfect fit there, but it kind of is a preference and taste issue in the garden. And like I say, you're going to plant these 8 to 10 inches apart, 1.5 inches deep. Once you find the popcorn seed that you want to grow, you know, some people have success taking the seed right out of the bag of their favorite brand.
Could you do that, really?
You can.
Okay, now this would be stuff that's just like in a jar, not the microwave stuff.
Right, and you can test it and see if it will grow, and you could soak it in water for 12 hours like you would with any popcorn seed, soak it in water for 12 hours, and then see if you can get it to germinate instead of doing the whole jar, right?
Yeah.
Because a lot of times the preparation and the drying that we'll discuss, that'll take that seed away from being viable and more into the delicious category.
Okay.
All right. And one of the 1 ear of corn, of popcorn, it produces a couple handfuls of kernels, and that's enough for 2 to 4 adults to have a serving of popcorn.
Okay, that's pretty good.
So I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there are a lot of people here at Illinois State University in the Department of Biology that are experts in this area.
In popcorn?
And corn in particular, as it turns out. And that's not even in agriculture, right? ISU's got the big guns. We got corn people in biology and in agriculture.
Well,
here.
You know, this is corn country.
Yeah. And an interesting detail I picked up is getting the seed off the cob, you rub the two cobs together and the seeds just come flying off, right?
Yes.
I thought that was
neat. Like BBs.
And so you're going to plant your corn and it's going to come up just like the corn does in the fields that all the cultivating farmers are chasing down. And
does it take that long? Does it take like all summer long?
Well, the thing is, you want to leave it on the plant, that ear, you want to leave it on the plant as long as possible.
Really? So if I put it in the ground now, I probably don't even want to think about taking it to harvesting it to like October?
Late summer, early fall at the earliest, right?
Alrighty,
at
then.
The earliest. So once you do get the corn up and it's grown and you've waited and your patience has been tested and you're looking at these bedraggled corn plants with the ears on them in your garden from the compound windows, that's when you take them off of the plant. And then you're going to have to dry those ears. So there's a couple ways to do it.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, growing your own popcorn. We've got to dry those ears. How do we do that?
We're going to pull the husk back, you know, gather it back like you're tying a ponytail up. And then you're going to hang the corn up in a cool, dry place for 3 to 4 weeks.
Oh, my goodness.
3 to 4 weeks.
Oh,
right.
That's a long wait for popcorn.
Right.
But I'll
so
do
I'm
it.
Starting to see there's a lot of work involved
there
in
is
getting
a, lot of
a
work.
Small amount of calories.
I have more admiration for Orville Redenbacher than I've ever had in my life.
Well, you know, they even have modified combines to collect the shorter ears that are closer to the ground. But you're going to hang that corn up, and then after, say, 4 weeks, before you put it all away, you want to test it to see if the kernels pop. Try a couple to see if they pop.
In a hot pan.
In a hot pan or in a microwave. And then if they don't, you want to go to another 1 to 2 weeks of drying.
Wow. Right. So drying is really a critical step with regards to popcorn.
It's critical for sure.
Okay.
And that allows the cooking process to take place, whether it's hot air or the conductive heat through the oil in the pan with the lid on it. Either way, the drying is necessary for that to happen. Now, there's another technique that can be used, and, you know, this kind of technique involves 200 degrees in the oven for 12 hours with the oven door open.
Oh, okay.
So that's not for everybody,
no,
right?
If you've got kids in your family, do not do that.
Yeah, there's some hazards involved with that. There's a gas hazard. There's a open combustible fire source hazard. But that's how it's done.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I always like to think of old-timey days.
Mm-hmm.
There was probably a time, you know, I was like, we haven't turned the heat on yet, kids, but quit your griping. I'm drying popcorn tonight. So, Johnny, you're going to stay up from 6 to midnight, and you're going to do fire
watch.
Guard on the open oven door. Yeah, how did that work out, right?
I don't know,
yeah,
but it must have worked.
Maybe watch the oven all night, you know, and you don't get any sleep, and you don't want any popcorn the next night because you're too tired.
Yeah, because then you have to go into therapy because you had to stay up and watch popcorn all night.
And then the funny thing is, after you do that oven drying, you still need another 1 to 2 weeks of cool drying.
Wow.
So why just go with the cool air drying and do it for 3 to 4 and add another
and
2 weeks on if you have to?
And it's safer. It's a lot safer. You know, and you know what? By just hanging it up, make it part of the decor
of
your house.
We're going to come back to that.
Oh, okay.
We're going to come back to that too because, you know, after it's all dried, hopefully you've used the hanging drying method and you've had the success, you've test popped. And it's ready to be stored. It's really simple. You can Ziploc it. You can mason jar with the sealed lid. Or you can use the plastic locking lid type Tupperware stuff.
Cool.
And it can go in the shelf or in the fridge, either one. So cool and dry. So I thought we could round up our chat and talk about some cornographic images.
Images. Okay. Is it safe for work?
It's safe. The FCC will not come kicking down our door with the jackbooted thugs.
Okay.
But we got the Japanese hole-less. That means free of a hole.
Okay.
Less stuff sticking in your teeth. And it grows and it produces a yellow to white colored kernels on an ear.
Okay, that's nice.
And then to expand on that cornographic image, there's a strawberry popcorn, which is really common, and it's pretty because the husks are kind of pinkish with the red kernels.
So that will make a really good decor while you're driving it.
Yeah, that's right. So you could either P. Allen Smith it, or you could Martha Stewart it, or you could Murfin grow it and have it hanging around and show it off.
That's beautiful.
And then there's the ornamental mini blue.
No, blue.
So now we got red, white, and blue corn.
Oh, man.
In the jars, right? Because you could mix it all together and give it away for Christmas presents and stuff. That would be
what
really
a great
cool.
idea.
And then there's another one that is the Red Husk Spectrum ornamental popcorn.
Oh, so is it strictly ornamental?
No, it's not. It's cool looking, but you can pop it.
Cool.
And here's the deal.
Yeah.
Blue, teal, and yellow kernels all on the same ear.
Man.
It's so beautiful.
Who developed that? Genius person.
While it's sitting out drying, you can just turn the TV off and sit and watch the corn dry.
This is how we have fun in Central Illinois. Okay, Murph, some great tips there for growing one's own popcorn. Now, next week on GLT's Grow, beware the gypsy moth and jumping worm. We're going to be talking about these pests next week. Now, do you have a gardening question? Maybe you've got a problem you'd like Murph to take on. We'll go to our website, wglt.org/grow. You fill in the form and you send it along to us. We would love to hear from you, and we do welcome photographs. Take a photograph of a sick plant or what have you. We'd love to hear from you and just submit those questions. Again, on our website, we'd love to hear from you, wglt.org/grow.
You can download the Grow podcast weekly at iTunes or at wglt.org. That's also where you can find the full show podcast or individual stories and interviews today from Charlie Schlinker, Judy Valente, and Laura Kennedy. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is Sound Ideas on GLT and wglt.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Popcorn by Hot Butter on Sound Ideas. That earworm made it to the top 10 on the Billboard Hot 100 in 1972. I'm Mike McCurdy. Pigs may soon fly in Chicago. That's if a group of designers gets its way and a piece of protest art gets approved to take off in Chicago. IPR's Rachel Otwell has the interview.
Wondering which of the brothers to blame. and watching for pigs on the wing.
That song is by Pink Floyd. It's off their album Animals, which was inspired in part by George Orwell's political fable, Animal Farm. Both works explore societal structures like class. These works provide much fodder for a design firm based in Chicago called New World Design. Just like the concept of pigs in flight, they find Donald Trump serving as president to be an absurdity. They're planning a project that would put four huge balloon pigs in front of Trump's name on his tower on the Chicago River. I spoke with Jeffrey Roberts, one of the planners, to find out more.
This kind of all starts back with the construction of the Trump building. Skid Morgan's and Merrill did a nice building there, and I think it contributes nicely to the city, and I think it works very well on the river. It does a lot of great things. When it went up, we were very surprised, designers, to see that the Trump logo wasn't on there in some bombastic way. And then in 2014, that happened. And of course, all the letters were added to the building in a grandiose style. It's been chided by the design community since. It's something that we joke about quite a lot in the office because it's two blocks from our office. We see it all the time. The thing that I think is unfortunate, whether it said Trump or Smith or Jones or whatever, it brands a very prominent location in the city. So many tourists and so many of us commute across the Michigan Avenue bridges and the Wabash bridges, State Street bridges every day. And it's that name that is so present in a very large scale in that prominent portion of the city. It's just inappropriate.
So obviously the election results had to change the way you thought about this.
There was a lot of frustration with that. The people in our office count themselves as independent voters, but we're a little dismayed that it went the way it did. So we, as a kind of a point of therapy, we decided to charrette this design problem. How would we block that sign? It was impractical to do some kind of permanent gesture. One of the other principals in my office had recently come across the Pink Floyd album that floated the pig above the Battersea Power Station in London. And we start talking about that. That is a representation of something that could be deployed here. And then we talked about, okay, let's make it a balloon. And then we tried to build a design rationale around that. And that led to the notion of turning them gold, which is Mr. Trump's fondness for gold interiors and something he's referenced as comfortable modernism. We chose four pigs because there would be one for each year that we will endure the presidency. They're flying and facing eastward toward Washington. There's a response to the Miss Piggy comments from the election phase of leadership. So we were really trying to build something that had a lot of meaning, all kind of built around the Orwellian notion of Animal Farm. The album, Animals album by Pink Floyd in 1977, was an interpretation of Animal Farm and in response to socioeconomic and political problems in Great Britain at the time. We reread the book and decided it really applies heavily to where we are politically in this country right now and thought that would be a good core representation.
So it sounds like the building mixed with the election resulted in this firm deciding to try a hand at being sort of installation artists. Is that right?
Yeah. No, we count ourselves as designers in our office. So whether, you know, we're handling a product design or architecture or anything, we feel that we have a capacity to design a broad range of things very competently. So we saw this as almost a job we had, and we tried to find a solution that would block the sign, you know, at least temporarily, and would have representative artistic meaning to it, and that's what we did. You know, one of the things that comes out of this is we feel that this project, this installation is very, very rational, and that is certainly in direct contrast to so much that has happened through the campaign and the current leadership.
And so logistics here, how do you get four massive pigs to float?
There is a lot of logistics, and we initially released this idea at the end of last year and kind of went quiet on it for a few months while we actually did the engineering and the design aspects for implementation, seeking out vendors, looking at the logistics with them and their materials and their requirements and whatnot. So what this boils down to is the way we would deploy it would be off of a barge. We would do it just as a single-day art installation. So the barge would come in early in the morning, you know, before the sun comes up, and be positioned. We would inflate the balloons. We would use a rigging system to hoist them all up at an even level. There's a very intricate triangulation system set on the tethering. Other engineers have designed such that it keeps them very buoyant, very stable, and in this, you know, this canyon of buildings, such that it's safe to do so even with, you know, some light to moderate winds. At some point in the day, right now what we're saying, no later than mid-afternoon, these things would be pulled back down, and they would be anchored to the boat and then taken south of the city where we could deflate them.
What do you hope this could lead to as far as conversations and issues people address? You don't necessarily consider yourselves to be activists, is that right?
No, we aren't. We're responding to kind of a social absurdity, and it's a political absurdity. We're not arguing for the Democrats or the Republicans, but when you see something this obscure, we're using our design skills to respond to it in a, you know, a realizable way, an artistic way. The response that we got from the initial release was mostly about people saying, you know what, you know, this seems like something that really represents our community. That's one of the things that we feel it comes from this, and that it is something that it has brought that community or reinforced that community that believes in a more inclusive and rational world that we should be living in.
Jeffrey Roberts of New World Design in Chicago spoke with IPR's Rachel Otwell. The firm aims to raise $250,000 to see this project come to life, and talks are ongoing with the city for approval. The plan is for the pigs to fly one day this summer. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Often the first stop for someone seeking help with an emotional problem is to see their pastor or another spiritual advisor. Faith communities have an important role to play in addressing mental health issues. That's according to Pat Turner, Outreach Director for the Center for Hope International Ministries in Bloomington, an independent Christian church. Turner is one of the presenters at today's McLean County Behavioral Health Community Forum at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Turner tells GLT's Judy Valente that a growing number of churches, like the Center for Hope, are trying to address not only the spiritual, but the physical and emotional well-being of its members.
We've always been a ministry that focuses on physical health, that focuses on mental health, that focuses on emotional health and all of those things. So that whole person, we have a ministry of balance to the whole person.
For many people who have an emotional problem, sometimes the first stop that they go to is their church, mm-hmm. their pastor.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, that is. And we're glad that this could be one of the stops that people can make. I think there's so much help. I like to emphasize our own name is Center for Hope Ministries. And I think so many times if you're facing issues of mental health, behavioral health, addiction, any of those issues, sometimes it's easy to get to a place that either you as an individual or either loved ones, caregivers, and other people begin to feel hopeless. And we like to let people know there is hope, there is help. We're not the only stop, but we're one of the pieces, I think, to the bigger puzzle where there's hope for help, for change, for well-being.
Well, that said, that people do go often to their pastor or their priest for this type of counseling. Sometimes people in ministry are not so well prepared in this. Is that also kind of the problematic flip side of going to your pastor?
Yeah, I don't know that I would call it problematic. I think it's just like if you're going for nutritional health. Your fix won't be found in one particular food group. So I believe it's a piece of the puzzle. And again, I think when people begin to see the different help sources in the community as a larger piece of a bigger puzzle, then they can say, my pastor may not have the detailed training in mental health, wellness, or addiction recovery, but he has a piece that is able to make a difference toward my well-being, and they can pull on that piece.
It seems as though your church is very involved and very concerned about this area of mental health. Do you think enough churches see that there is a connection between a person's mental and emotional well-being and their spiritual life, their inner life?
I do believe that that's an area for growth in the body of Christ. This is just for us to see the whole person. And I do think that's something that our ministry puts a lot of emphasis in, is looking at a person from a holistic point of view. Choose healthy lifestyles or choose healthy roads, healthy settings, and healthy environments. And I think that's something that we play into as a ministry, to really look at the larger part of the person and our community.
So I think what you're saying is that you don't want people to look at having depression or having an addiction of some sort to alcohol or to drugs as being a moral failure, a lack of faith, but that it's an emotional problem, it's an illness that needs to be addressed like any other.
We definitely see it as something that if Jesus were on the earth, when he walked the earth, he gave such an excellent example. He healed all manner of disease. He dealt with all things that bring heaviness. He says, I wish above all things that you have life and that you have it more abundantly. And so in that same vein, yes, I'm saying we want to see people live their very best lives, live the happiest, healthiest lives that they can. And yes, that's not just met by dealing with their moral failings or their moral shortcomings, but it's dealing with a larger person.
Years ago, maybe still today in some families, people would not want to admit a mental health problem. I mean, that would be something to hide, especially from your peers at church. You're saying you've got to get rid of that mindset. That's wrong.
I won't say right or wrong. I'll say it's not healthy. I'll say that you're going to do a lot better if you're in an environment that says, hey, we embrace you just where you are. And if your shortcoming is in your physical body, or your shortcoming is in your moral state, or your shortcoming is in your mental, emotional state, it's okay. We love you. We want to meet you right there. And there's an answer in the Word of God that can help you get to a better place. And that's where hope comes in.
What can the faith communities in our community here do better?
I think listening is important. I always love the fact that we have two ears and one mouth. I think as we listen to each other, we listen to people who are just coming from various points of life, hear what's going on, that we can then address some of the needs a little better. So I think the more that we do that, we as churches go back to the Word, just really go back to that resource and say, what's in there? What do we already know? And keep that heart of love. Just keep that example that Jesus gave and know that he's still healing all manner of disease.
How much are you working in an interfaith capacity? How much are you working with, say, the temple or the various mosques that are here in McLean County?
In my actual capacity as an outreach director, I love the fact that I get chance to be out and about in this community, and I absolutely love this community. One of the places that I get to go is there's a clergy association with associated with the Broman healthcare system, and I don't remember the exact number of faith entities that take part, but literally it's got to be close to 100 different entities that come together from different faith walks. And this is one of the areas that that we are addressing this year. So it's nice to be a part of that, where there's opportunities in other ways. Our bishop, Pastor Taylor.
Larry Taylor.
Yes. He built on to, as an addition to our church and sanctuary, gymnasium, where people in the community can come and play basketball or walk or become fit. There's a weight room, exercise room, dance room. And so I think those are some of the ways that we interact community-wide. And he is very generous about, you know, if it's not booked, you know, people are able to come in and take use of that. So those are some of the ways that we interact. And I think the more that we do this across the spectrum would be nice. The more that we do that, the more progress we'll see.
We have been talking with Patricia Turner. She is a minister with the Center for Hope International Ministries, which has a large outreach on mental health issues and emotional issues. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
Pat Turner is part of a panel of faith leaders at the McLean County Behavioral Health Community Forum underway today at the BCPA. This is Sound Ideas. One of the best voices in rock and an architect of grunge is dead. Chris Cornell was 52 years old. Initial signs are pointing to suicide. He helped found Audioslave and Soundgarden. You're listening to Fell on Black Days, Soundgarden on Sound Ideas. Soundgarden and singer Chris Cornell, who was found dead this morning at the age of 52. He may have committed suicide. The National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 1-800-273-8255. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. I'm Mike McCurdy.